With our special guest tonight, Gary Stearman, we're talking about his work, Time Travelers of the Bible. We'll talk more about it when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Gary Stearman with us. Gary, let's talk a little bit more about Ezekiel's wheel, then I want to break down some of your chapters in your book, The Time Travelers of the Bible. I mean, do you interpret it as a craft?
I do, yeah. Absolutely. Now, and this brings up a very interesting question, because classical Judeo-Christianity has always said Ezekiel had a vision. And in fact, if you examine the wording of his vision, there is a Hebrew word that specifically means to see something as in a dream, but there's another word that translates into the English sighting. Ezekiel had a sighting, and there's just no doubt about it. And what he sighted was what he called a whirlwind coming out of the north, a whirlwind of fire, and it came very close to him, and it landed in front of him. And the description of it is much too complicated to spend time on this morning. However, he does describe it as a device piloted by an individual sitting under a clear canopy, which he calls a firmament. And he called that individual, the Son of Man. And so he sees this ship, he's visited by it, and most people don't know, George, that he actually was invited to come aboard the ship, and he took a ride in it. And this is astounding to me, because this is an incredible reality. In Ezekiel 3:12, it says, "The Spirit took me up, and I heard behind me the voice of a great rushing. I also heard the noise of the wings of the living creatures that touched one another, and the noise of the wheels over against them."
Jeez.
But here, get this. This is amazing. He said, "So the Spirit lifted me up and took me away. I went in bitterness in the heat of my spirit, but the hand of the Lord was strong upon me." And I interpret that, and I've checked this out in the original Hebrew, and it suggests that something is pushing down on him like a weight as this machine takes off. And I can only conclude from that Ezekiel is feeling G-force.
Good point.
You know, and he calls it, "The hand of the Lord was strong upon me." And so he was visited by the Son of Man, who flew him to Jerusalem to review the sins of the people of Israel and to explain to them why they had been defeated by the Babylonians. And then this, and I can only call it a ship, although in Hebrew it is the Merkava Moftim, the chariot of wonders, finally took him back to Babylon and dropped him off. And he began to prophesy about the reasons why Israel had been defeated and taken prisoner in Babylon. But George, the Bible is absolutely loaded with real accounts of real people traveling in ways and in dimensions that we can only guess at.
Oh, and it's right there for us,
yeah,
isn't it?
Absolutely.
I mean, that's what's so remarkable about all that.
And I am very much, and as you know, I'm a pastor and have pastored a church now since 1983. And I just simply teach the Bible. That's all I do.
Do you mention UFOs in church?
Absolutely. We talk about UFOs. We talk about time travel. We talk about modern science from the perspective, from its spiritual perspective.
Are your parishioners open to that?
They certainly are.
That's great.
Very much so. And in fact, they think of it as a breath of fresh air, because, you know, we try to take the superstition and the half-truth out of the Bible and simply read what is there.
You need to make Coast to Coast required listening in your church.
George, I have to tell you, I've listened since the Art Bell days.
Yep. That goes way back. You talk about time traveling.
Jeez. Indeed. And may I say, it's just a real pleasure to be with you tonight, because I've listened to you for years now, and I feel like I know you.
Good.
Thanks for having me.
That's good. Well, you're very pleasant, too. Some of your chapters, here's one, The Arrow of Time. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, the arrow of God. And by that, I'm talking about time as an arrow. Now, science speaks of time as flowing in one direction, and they refer to the arrow of time. And physicists, in their theories, where they are talking about matter and energy, speak of the universe as increasingly disordered. That is to say, and you can see this for yourself. For example, if you have a piece of shiny new metal and you put it out in the dirt for a while and come back, pick it up, you'll discover that it's corroded and it's being eaten away. And if you come back a little while later, it's gone. It's just a heap of rust.
Yeah.
And that's called entropy. And it is also referred to as the arrow of time. Time, like an arrow, is moving in one direction inexorably toward increasingly increasing disorder or an increasingly disordered universe. And would you believe that the Bible really speaks volumes to this subject? It says that the reason this entropy exists is because once upon a time there was a great battle in heaven between God the Creator and a being he had created called Satan. And the result of this battle was a dissolution of a highly ordered universe into a state of disorder. And so I have a chapter called Satan Impaled on the Arrow of Time. And it describes the history of Satan as a revolutionary who thought that he could do a better job of running the universe. And lo and behold, he discovered that he had actually fractured the universe. And the Bible then seeks a solution to this problem and finds the solution in the appearance of Christ. And so when Christ came to earth, it was not only to save humanity, but it was to save the broken universe. And if you haven't ever heard this expressed before, it may sound strange, but to me that is one of the major themes in the Bible. And somebody as wise as Solomon once said, you know, I gave my heart to know wisdom, and I received the gift of wisdom, but wisdom has taught me that all is vanity under the sun. Behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit, he says. That which is crooked cannot be made straight. That which is wanting cannot be numbered. And Solomon went into a long dissertation on entropy, on how the universe is running down, and Solomon proposed a solution, and of course it is the solution that the Bible proposes, that that man follow the way of God. And a lot of people, you know, immediately say, okay, you've broken now over into the field of religion. But to me, religion is something entirely different than what I'm talking about. To me, religion is man's view of what God is doing, and I don't even think of myself as a religious person. I think of myself as a spiritual observer, with my eyes having been opened by being able to understand the scriptures of the Bible. So the Bible speaks to all of these things you're talking about. It speaks to the fear you mentioned a minute ago. For example, after we talked, I thought about something that Jesus once said about the end times. He said, there shall be signs in the sun and in the moon and in the stars, and upon the earth distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring. Now, George, doesn't that sound like a description of the upheavals that we're beginning?
Oh, right now.
Yeah, if you read the releases from science, you know, concerning the sun appears to be doing some odd things.
More so now than our lifetime, that's for sure.
Yeah, and there's genuine concern that maybe one of these great coronal magnetic ejections can actually stop one of our power grids.
If we get hit, Gary, with an X flare, and it's a direct hit, it could knock out the power grids for months.
Could. And it would change our lives. All those little video screens that people are carrying around would quit working.
We could barely go without electricity for 2 days.
Absolutely.
You know, let alone a few months. I mean, if this thing hit, let's say, during the dead of winter, when people need their furnaces to work.
Sure.
What are they going to do? I mean, they may freeze to death.
And it's grim when you stop and think about the possibilities. But I think you make a good point, which is that right now people are beginning to be conscious of this, where in decades past, I think that we were all content that all was well and all was stable. It would be just the same when you got up the next morning. Perhaps that feeling is disappearing to some degree.
One of your chapters, Time as the Enemy. Why is time the enemy?
Time is, it basically is the enemy because time essentially, while it allows you to do everything that you do, it also keeps you from doing the things that you want to do.
Because it goes too fast.
Because it goes too fast. And by the way, has anybody said to you, time seems like it's spinning faster these days?
Every year, Gary.
Well, this is a subjectivity of time. Augustine, back in the 5th century A.D., remarked that time was entirely subjective, depending on how you perceived it. And Augustine said that you couldn't even really depend on time actually being there. It was a human perception. And yet, where I write about time as the enemy, I begin by quoting a British scientist by the name of C.P. Snow, who said, essentially, we are trapped in time. And he said, number one, you cannot win. He said, you can't get something for nothing because matter and energy are conserved in a particular way. Number two, you can't even break even because you can't return back to the same energy state. He says everything's running down and time is moving forward and time is the enemy. And number three, you can't get out of the game, he said, because until time or until everything completely runs down to zero, you're in the game. In other words, the more you look at time, the more you see that it is your enemy and that you have a very limited amount of it. And as Solomon said, vanity, vanity, all is vanity, which causes man then to look for a remedy. What can I do? And of course, what you'd like to be able to do is live forever in a...
Sure, or slow it down.
Yeah. Live forever in an eternal state. Well, you know, I'm sure I'm not the first one that's mentioned this, but the Bible suggests that it is possible to live forever in an eternal state, thereby destroying time, the enemy, once and for all. And I go into some rather lengthy descriptions of things, for example, the Apostle Peter, who started out life as a fisherman, by the way, and he was kind of a rough guy.
Was he a good fisherman, though, by the way?
I'll bet he was. Probably. But he was a rough-hewn character, and the Bible depicts him that way.
He had blisters on his fingers, you know, I bet.
Sure, blisters on his fingers.
That's how they used to catch fish with those days. They just hold the line. They didn't have reels in those days, did they?
Yeah, they cast nets and they cast lines with their bare hands, sure. And he was called to be a disciple. Now, here's Peter, who probably spoke common Greek, and he comments on creation. And he says, see that all these things are going to be dissolved. In other words, in the end, it's all going to run down, and it's going to have to be recreated, at what the Bible refers to as a new heavens and a new earth. Peter says, and by the way, this is coming from the mouth of a fisherman on the Sea of Galilee, seeing that all these things should be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in all holy lifestyle, looking for and hastening unto the coming of the day of God, wherein, he says, all the heavens being on fire shall be dissolved, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. So here's this fisherman from Sea of Galilee, waxing eloquent about entropy and about dissolution, about the need for the universe to be rebuilt. And that's what I have written in that chapter entitled...
How would he know this?
How would he? Unless he had communed with the creator of it all, which I happen to believe is the case. How would he know, being just a fisherman? And, of course, there was another fisherman, the Apostle John, and these guys were... just rough-hewn guys that were out there sunburned on the Sea of Galilee, and suddenly they were made over through a series of events.
Oh, yeah.
And they became
Do you think they're glad they were picked?
Yeah.
You do?
I do. In other words, being chosen, not necessarily being the best fate.
Because they didn't act that way.
No. Well, that's correct. Yeah. But the point is, they were taken to places that no Galilean fisherman would ever go. And this is the beauty of the Bible to me. It kind of speaks in practical terms about extraordinarily real commodities like time, space, and like eternity and entropy. The second law of thermodynamics, where things are running down and need correcting, and then they write in their epistles that, yes, there is a remedy, and there is a correction, and indeed there will be a new heavens and a new earth. So that's why the Bible has always been presented as a book that offers hope.
Gary, tell me about some of these dark powers that are out there. You call them transdimensional raiders.
Transdimensional raiders, indeed, and that's what they are, because from time to time, they pop into our reality, and the earliest recorded appearance of the transdimensional raiders is in the book of Enoch, which is not a part of the Bible per se, but is considered to be perhaps the earliest writing. And fairly well understood in the days of Jesus and the apostles. That is the book of Enoch quoted in the Bible. And Enoch talked about time. And in the first very opening words of his little book, he says, "The words of the blessing of Enoch, wherewith he blessed the elect and the righteous who will be living in the day of tribulation." So Enoch was looking forward, and by the way, this book is documented as having been written long, long, long before the time of Christ. He was looking forward to our future, the same future seen by the Apostle John, which is yet future to us. And so Enoch is also a great example of a time traveler. In fact, in his book, he has a whole chapter about walking up to what he called a flying house. And he entered the flying house and was taken on a guided tour of the earth, which is one of the chapters in the book of Enoch. Does that sound familiar at all?
Yeah.
And the flying house, by the way, was a wonder to behold. It was hardly anything you would call a house. Well, I find that the books that provided the original information for the Bible, the inspiration of the writers of the Bible, is all on a par with what we've been talking about tonight. It touches upon the vital realities that we all live in right now. And it's the greatest source of hope in the entire world when you really look at it that way. And when I study and teach Bible prophecy, I always teach it from that perspective, not from the perspective of fear, but from the perspective of hope.
Tell me more.
Beg your pardon?
Tell me more about that.
Well, what are you going to do? That is to say, if for example, you see some impending disaster, there's absolutely no way in the world that you can control it. Let's say that it's
Category 5 hurricane. It's coming.
It's funny you should say that, because that was just coming out of my mouth. A Cat 5 hurricane. What are you going to do? I know what most people do. They pray. And I'm talking about people who have never darkened the door of a church. They pray. And what are you praying for? Well, we're praying for mercy, for providence. The implication there, George, is that there is some force that can control the weather or modify the weather. Now, do you believe it or not? Actually, I do.
I do, too. We've done many experiments, and we call it the conscious mind, the collective consciousness. But I think there's something steering that. Call it whatever you want, God, whatever.
Well, have you ever heard of Job in the Bible?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. And Job had this fascinating experience in which the Lord tested him in a way that I certainly wouldn't want to be tested. But at the end of the book of Job, there's this incredible narrative in which God speaks directly to Job.
Hold on. We're at the bottom. Okay, with our guest Gary Stearman, author of Time Travelers of the Bible, and you're next with him on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Gary, before we take some calls, tell us the story of Job.
Well, George, this is the thing I wanted to mention, and it's this, that God is depicted in the book of Job as describing to Job the fact that he controls the weather. And he says, not only do I control the weather, but he says, I control gravitational forces. He calls gravitational forces the sweet influences of the Pleiades and the bands of Orion. He says to Job, by what way is the light parted, which scattereth the east wind upon the earth? Well, you know, George, that east wind goes around the equator, and it is driven by the sun. And here we find in an ancient book, the book of Job, a description of that mechanism. And God also says to Job, have you entered the treasuries of the snow or the hail, which I have reserved unto the time of trouble against the day of battle and war? In other words, God implies, and there's much, much more, that he controls not only the gravitational influences, the weather, he also controls the output of the sun, and he goes to all the trouble to explain all this to Job in the 37th and 38th chapters of the book of Job. So I see science here. A lot of people would see a kind of a primitive guesswork about how things operate, but I actually see God explaining to Job how he operates the universe. And to me, this is enormously comforting to know that there is somebody in control.
All right. You know, you touched on Satan, the devil.
Yes.
What do you think this entity is, anyway? Who is it?
The Bible describes him as one of the throne guardians of God, called a cherub. In the Hebrew, the word is kiruv, and it means a very powerful super being, second only to God himself. And Satan is described as having been a guardian at the throne of God and a watcher over a particular kingdom. And that kingdom, of course, included Earth. Satan is described as having been extremely beautiful, intelligent, and also, unfortunately, power-hungry. And he said, one day, I will be like the Most High. He tried to overthrow God, and he broke the protocols of heaven, and the rest is history. It's the long history of the broken universe, which is the story of the Bible. And the fact is that the Lord Jesus Christ came at the center of the timeline precisely to heal the broken universe, and of course, in the process, also to take those to him who would were seekers of salvation. So this is a beautiful, big picture, and I try to cover that whole big picture in Time Travelers of the Bible.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I'm at.
Okay, let's take some calls. Let's go to Cornelius in Louisiana. Hey, Cornelius, go ahead.
George and Gary, God bless both of y'all. I want to thank you, George, and the Coast to Coast listeners and stuff for praying for my mom. She's dying of blood cancer. Share y'all. Believe me, y'all's prayers.
It works.
And she's getting better.
Good.
But my question tonight for Mr. Gary is this, and I'd love to get your book, sir. I was talking to your call screener, Mr. Will, and he, I want to know, do you believe in the rapture? And if not, then... And this is my personal belief about the rapture. I think we'll have to go through it just like Job did. It'll be a trial and a test for us during tribulation. So that's my viewpoint, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, and I'll speak to it this way.
Sure.
In the church today, there is a division of belief between those who believe that the Lord is going to return and take his followers to heaven prior to a time of judgment that's about to befall this earth. The other group believes that they will go through that period of judgment and be protected while going through it. And I don't regard this difference of belief as an essential to salvation. In other words, I think honest men can differ on this subject, and they do. I personally believe that the church will be caught up to be with the Lord prior to the time that the earth is judged, and that's the best way I can say it.
What do you think of parallel universes, Gary?
There are parallel universes. In fact, there are many The Bible seems to speak of parallel universes as being plural. For example, when Paul, while he was out traveling in the country of Galatia, was at one point stoned and left for dead. Now, I happen to believe that he was killed and he was raised up from the dead. You don't have to believe that, but he was very badly injured. And later on, he writes, he says, I knew a man in Christ about 14 years ago, whether in the body or out of body, I cannot tell. God knows. He says, such a one was caught up to the third heaven, he said. Well, he's speaking about himself, and he describes himself as having been caught up to the third heaven. That is what we would call another dimension. He saw things there, and he says this, and I'm quoting, he was caught up into paradise and heard unspeakable words, which it is not lawful for a man to utter. In other words, he actually went through the dimensional veil. He saw and heard things, which he was cautioned not to repeat when he came back. And this is one of many, many episodes in the Bible that tells us that the Bible deals, as a matter of routine, with interdimensional travel.
Huh. Well, what do you think? Do you believe that?
I do. I really and truly do. You may remember the story of the stoning of Stephen in the book of Acts. Stephen, one of the early followers of Christ, was stoned to death. And at one point, prior to his being stoned, he looked up into heaven, and he reported to everyone who was listening to him that he saw an opening through which he was able to see into heaven as one would look through a window. And you can either take that as a hallucination on his part or maybe some flight of spiritual fancy, but right. I think he actually was able to see through that dimensional portal, and then just a few moments later, he was stoned to death. And time and time and time again, George, you do see the Bible speaking about interdimensional perception as though it's very much a daily reality.
Maybe it opens up right before death. Is that possible?
It's possible. In fact, it's not uncommon in stories of near-death experience and deathbed experiences. I think we've all had relatives who have died, friends and relatives, and there has been some indication that they were looking at something just before they died, something that wasn't in the room. And maybe they were looking over into that dimension, which we cannot see. Then you could have a big debate about why are we not permitted to look beyond the veil. And that in itself is a large topic in the Bible.
All right, next up, let's go to west of the Rockies. Ron is in California. Go ahead, Ron. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Gary,
yes.
I can't find your TV program on for the last year and a half or so.
Actually, we are in the process of moving. You're just going to have to keep searching. We do have a 30-minute weekly television presentation, and it depends on where you are. You're just going to have to keep looking.
Some people get it, some people can't.
And it's called Prophecy in the News, by the way. We do have a website, prophecyinthenews.com, where you can watch our television presentations and daily updates. So you can get it there, Ron.
What are some of the prophecies of the future, Gary?
Some of the prophecies of the future deal with the strange, almost outlandish events that we're seeing in the Middle East right now. We see the countries, for example, that are experiencing the Arab Spring uprisings, Libya, Egypt, we see Gaza, we see Tunisia and Syria. We see all these countries that are being racked by these uprisings in the street. And we can look at the minor prophets, such as Zechariah and Zephaniah. And, you know, George, I have to tell you that very few people read the minor prophets, but if you do, you find the names of these countries and the descriptions of what would happen to them in the latter days. And believe me, it's what's happening right now.
It's in these prophets?
Yes, sir.
Prophecies?
It is. And we find, for example, the the word Gaza, and of course that's in the news. We have Hamas in Gaza launching rockets into Israel, and we find that very thing being described by the prophet Zephaniah. And reading the Bible over a period of time, you come to the inescapable conclusion that somebody was able to peer forward through time and write about the things that are happening in our world right now.
I've always suspected someone like Leonardo da Vinci had that ability, too.
You know, I think Leonardo got his inspiration maybe extra-dimensionally. There are hints that, he had access to a kind of a well of knowledge that we don't all touch, and I think maybe you're right.
Next up, we go to our wild card line. It's Jimmy in Hollywood. Hi, Jimmy. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks. Hey, Gary, I just wanted to say I like the idea of time travel, and the Bible stories are all pretty cool and everything, but I just think about them like stories because I'm an atheist, and mm-hmm. I was just wondering, do you ever stop to consider that, you know, maybe none of that stuff is, like, true in a total sense? It's neat stories, and there are sometimes tie-ins you can make, but it could just be accidental or circumstantial. Do you ever just even consider the idea that it's all just a bunch of old stories?
Actually, I do. And to my satisfaction, the stories are self-validating. Now, I realize that this is a matter of faith, and it's my faith, but on the other hand, atheism is a faith as well. I've often said you couldn't be an atheist if there were no God. You'd have to call yourself something else because you wouldn't have anybody to oppose. Therefore, I kind of think of atheism as a faith in and of itself. So you have your faith. I have my faith. I would certainly like to persuade you to mine because mine has the hope of redemption and a person who came to Earth to redeem us, which I kind of like.
What if somebody time traveled, Gary, and somehow went into a parallel universe, came back with wrong information, maybe about them, not about us?
A pseudo-prophet.
A pseudo-prophet.
A pseudo-prophet. Somebody who came back with false information, you know.
or accurate information about a different place.
That's kind of fascinating because the Bible does mention in the Old Testament false prophets, in the New Testament false apostles, who did obtain information from the wrong place. We have Saul traveling to a spirit medium to obtain information and receiving a curse because he did. In other words, he found what he wanted to find, but in the process, because it was through the wrong channel, he was condemned for that. So I think that the scenario you mentioned is actually possible. You can look in the wrong places to try to seek information. And there are dark places and there are bright places. And I think the Bible is there specifically to act as a guidebook so you won't go to the dark places.
Next up, we go east of the Rockies, Gary, Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Hi, Gary. Thank you.
Hello, gentlemen.
Hi.
Hello. You know, Gary, because of you, I'm honored. I feel honored to have the name Gary.
Well, likewise.
I am a subscriber to the magazine, and I watch the show weekly, so I know a lot about what you've been doing, and I really miss J.R. Church. Any case, I want to throw an idea at you. You know, you're just talking about dimensionality, and I'm so glad you were, because that's what I wanted to talk about. You know, it's always been said that, or lately it's been said that the spiritual realm is basically in a dimension that's higher than ours, like maybe as many as 12 dimensions, where we're stuck in the four. And sometimes when I try to explain that to people, they don't understand, you know, the eternity and all that stuff. Well, it's kind of like a video game. A video game is basically in two dimensions, but we're in four. You know, and they have a time limit, and then we can see it. And that's kind of the way the eternity is. We aren't real. We aren't in the real reality. The reality is in the universal eternity, and when we're just a short time, like you were just talking about time ending and stuff, we're just in a short time of all the eternity. And I just thought I'd ask you about what you think about that.
Well, you know, that's fascinating, Gary, and I have a chapter in my book that's entitled The Software of Time. And actually, I believe that the Bible presents the universe as a software system. That is to say, it was created by a God,
mm-hmm.
and the method he used for his creation was that he wrote an exquisite software program. And that program is referred to in several places because the Lord is spoken of as having created the universe with the Word. And in ancient days, the Jews said that the Lord spoke the universe into existence with the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. So what they were saying was that he had a 22-letter software code with which he wrote the universe into existence. The book of Hebrews says that he now upholds it by the same software system, and he upholds it on a moment-by-moment basis. So I've got a chapter called The Software of Time, and to me, it's really fascinating. That would explain, for example, the miracle of healing a man born blind, because, George, you think about that Jesus healing a man born blind, that man had never seen. He had no neural
idea, nothing.
Nothing. His brain was not neurally developed. His eyeballs were atrophied. The optic nerves were atrophied. And so that healing, as described in the Bible, of a man born blind, which, by the way, was one of the messianic promises, would require not just healing eyeballs, but completely rewiring an atrophied nervous system. Well, the only way you could do such a thing is if you control the software of time. And so that's what I have in one chapter of my book.
That's interesting. Let's go to Detroit, Michigan. Gracie, it's your turn. First-time caller.
Hi. Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi, Gracie.
Hi, Gary.
Hello.
I have a question regarding what you were discussing earlier on time being finite, and that there is a beginning and there is an end. And I was wondering how this concept translates over into or compares to the concept of the quote-unquote eternal kingdom of heaven, because at that point, are we still talking about time being finite, or is it that just this reality or this dimension is finite? Because at that point, we're talking two different things.
Yeah, we really are. In fact, the Bible makes a clean separation between what it refers to as time and what it refers to as eternity. And eternity has a completely different system or scale of measuring things than time does. So time is finite, eternity is infinite, and the idea or the ideal is preserved there. I personally believe that the Bible presents eternity as a much more real, quote-unquote, place than the place we now live. That is, eternity is more real than time. Time is simply a subset of eternity. Or, as I mentioned a minute ago, it's like software that was written for a specific purpose, and it is definitely finite, it is time-limited, and has a purpose.
We're going to take this break and come right back with another full hour of final questions with Gary Stearman, author of his book, Time Travelers of the Bible. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com, and I shall be right back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.